It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Libya's parliament ousted the prime minister in wake of illegal oil shipment. South Sudan treason trial gets underway. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The Libyan parliament has ousted the nation's prime minister in a no-confidence vote after a North Korean-flagged tanker that illegally loaded crude oil at a rebel-held eastern port reportedly reached international waters. A spokesman for the General National Congress, Omar Hamaden, said the GNC Tuesday named the country's defense minister, Abdullah Al-Thani, as interim prime minister to replace Ali Zidane. The move was prompted by news the tanker, Morning Glory, had taken advantage of poor weather to escape naval ships escorting it to a government port and to head for open sea. In Washington Tuesday, U.S. spokesperson Jen Psaki said the United States is following political developments closely in Libya.
You know, political transitions take time, and especially from a four-decade dictatorship to a truly democratic system. We recognize that the Libyan government and the Libyan people are facing significant challenges in their democratic transition. This is not surprising. So we will continue to support the democratically elected Libyan government and its people. We appreciate the leadership of the prime minister who navigated a fragile time in Libya's transition, and will continue to monitor and be in close touch on the ground about the situation as well.
She said the United States had been informed in advance of the decision. There's been no immediate reaction from Mr. Zidane on his ouster. In South Sudan, a treason trial of four men accused of trying to overthrow the government of President Salva Kiir opened Tuesday in Juba amid tight security. Rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar demanded the four be pardoned before Ethiopian-based peace talks resume. Mr. Kiir insists violence in the country broke out in December as part of a coup attempt. The four face multiple charges, including spreading false information, treason, and inciting violence. They previously denied plotting a coup. They were part of a group of 11 arrested after the violence broke out. Seven were released and sent to Kenya after President Uhuru Kenyatta offered to mediate. Tuesday, Mr. Kenyatta began a state visit to Ethiopia, where he met the prime minister, who is suggesting a regional intervention force may be needed in South Sudan. Martha Vanderwolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Ethiopia's Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn says deployment of a regional stability and protection force to South Sudan should not be delayed.
It will be very bad to have a failed state again in our region. So we urge the international community to respond as quickly as possible to our requests so that we rescue this country.
Several East African countries such as Kenya, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Djibouti and Burundi have indicated they are ready to send troops to South Sudan. Nearly 3 months of fighting has left thousands dead and close to 1 million displaced from their homes. The East African bloc IGAD is mediating peace negotiations between the government and rebel forces in Addis Ababa. Despite the signing of a cessation of hostilities agreement in January, fighting continues and the talks are making little progress. Heads of state from East Africa will meet Thursday in Addis Ababa to discuss the details of the proposed stabilization and protection force. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
In Sudan, security forces Tuesday clashed with students at Khartoum University who have links to the Darfur region. Reuters reports one student was killed. Security forces used tear gas and batons to battle some 200 students amid escalating violence in their region, which they blame on government forces. Monday, the United Nations said attacks in Sudan's Darfur region forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. The UN Refugee Agency said thousands of refugees are fleeing atrocities in northern Nigeria. The UNHCR says some 2,000 Nigerians were forced to flee in a neighboring Niger over the past 4 weeks. It says other refugees have fled to Cameroon and Chad. It says tens of thousands have fled since suspected Boko Haram militants began their violent campaign in 2009 to create an Islamist state in northern Nigeria. The United States Tuesday condemned what it called the use of heavy-handed tactics by police in Burundi to break up opposition party meetings in which several people were injured and arrested. It cited the breakup of a peaceful meeting by the women's wing of the United for National Progress Party as they tried to mark International Women's Day. Separately, police tried to prevent an opposition meeting at the headquarters of the Movement for Solidarity and Democracy Party. The U.S. statement encouraged the respect of the democratic process so Burundi can hold free, fair, and peaceful elections next year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Some of these stories can be found at our internet website, voanews.com.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The long-awaited trial of South Sudan's alleged coup plotters has begun.
It is known by the Constitution, whenever you try to overthrow the government, this is an offense. And it is known as treason. And they are categorized under Chapter 5 of the Penal Code of South Sudan.
James Mayen is the lead prosecutor for the South Sudan government. Meanwhile, former vice president and now rebel leader Riek Machar has welcomed, but with condition, an African Union inquiry into human rights abuses during the conflict. And a Namibian rights group launches voter education ahead of the November election.
Quite a large amount of people are welcoming this type of voter education drive. This is an indication that indeed a lot of Namibians are really going to be motivated to come out and vote.
Phil Yanagolo is executive director of NAMRIGHT. Libya's prime minister is ousted by parliament. Zimbabwe's clothing industry calls on the government to curb the importation of cheap clothing. And Save a Child's Heart Group improves cardiac care in Africa. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The long-awaited trial of four former Sudan People's Liberation Movement leaders got underway Tuesday in Juba. The South Sudan government has charged the four with attempting to overthrow a legitimate government. As Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba, the atmosphere both inside and outside the courtroom was tense.
A five-judge panel is hearing the case against former SPLM Secretary General Pagan Amum Okech, former Security Minister Oya Ideng Ajak, former Deputy Defense Minister Majak Dagot Atem, and former envoy of the semi-autonomous South Sudan government to the U.S., Ezekiel Lol Gatkwolf. All four were dressed in business attire and appeared calm, occasionally whispering to one another during the proceedings. Security was tight, with heavily armed soldiers and police deployed both inside and outside the courtroom. In a small, steamy courtroom, the prosecution made their opening statement outlining the government's case against the four suspects. James Mayen is the state's lead prosecutor in the case.
These are the charges that are related to the coup, and it is known by the Constitution. Whenever you try to overthrow the government, this is an offense, and it is known as treason, and they are categorized under Chapter 5 of the Penal Code of South Sudan.
Mayen says the main suspects are former Vice President Riek Machar Teny, former Unity State Governor Taban Dengai, and former Environment Minister Alfred Ladu Gore, all of whom remain in hiding. But Mayen says they will be tried whenever they are finally apprehended. Other charges against the suspects include inciting the masses, subverting a constitutional government, insurgency, and causing disaffection among the police and the army. Mayen told the court the government has enough evidence to prove the suspects attempted to overthrow Salva Kiir's government. Mayen pointed to a press release written by Machar and distributed at a news conference on December 6th, 9 days before the violence broke out. During that news conference, Riek Machar and some of the political detainees accused President Kiir of having dictatorial tendencies. They also accused Mr. Kiir of making decisions without consulting other SPLM party officials. Mayen says his other evidence is an audio recording of a conversation between the suspects on the night the violence broke out in Juba. Mayen asked if he could play the recorded audio in court, but the judges told him he could do that later in the trial. Although she was not arrested, government also accuses Rebecca Nyandeng, the widow of the late SPLM leader John Garang and former Education Minister Peter Aduok Nyaba, of being part of the alleged coup plotters. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar, who is now leader of the rebel SPLM opposition, says he welcomes the formation of a commission of inquiry by the African Union to investigate allegations of human rights abuses during South Sudan's conflict. The commission is headed by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. But Riek Machar says the South Sudan government should give his group access to cases of reported abuse in four South Sudan states.
He said they were floating an idea of forming a commission, a human rights commission, to investigate the violations in South Sudan. I said, well, that's fine.
Looking at how things are moving on in South Sudan of late, there was a shooting in Juba on Wednesday. How is your assessment of the situation?
Well, I know nothing about it, but I'm not surprised such situation shall continue in Juba with the contradictions that are happening in Juba, in the system being run by Salva Kiir. So it's not a surprising event to me. I expect more of it.
Is your group involved in what happened in Juba?
Well, as I said, these are the contradictions within the system being run by Salva Kiir. So expect more of it.
The delegation from South Sudan and from your group went back to consult with the principals on how to end this political crisis in South Sudan. Is there anything you will tell us about that?
My delegation has not yet returned to me. They're still in Addis. I know that they have been given recess up to the 20th of March. I hope they will come to brief me and the rest of the leadership, and we'll discuss what progress they have made and what difficulties they are facing.
There is one interesting development. In Juba, President Kiir formed a committee to look into reorganizing a meeting of the political bureau. And the head of your delegation, Taban Dengai, is said to be among those who are supposed to look into this committee that is to revive the political bureau of the SPLM.
Such a meeting cannot be held when some members of the Politburo are still under detention. The Secretary General, Pagana Mum, is still under detention. If Salva Kiir wants such a meeting to take place, he should release the four detainees because they are members of the movement. And the Secretary General is the key person in the meetings of the Politburo. He's the chief administrator of the party.
Former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar was speaking with John Tanza via a satellite phone from an undisclosed location in South Sudan. Libya's interim National Assembly has approved a vote of no confidence in Prime Minister Ali Zidane, naming the current defense minister to replace him on an interim basis. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Libyan state TV announced the sacking of Prime Minister Ali Zeidan in a vote of no confidence Tuesday by the National Assembly with 124 votes to dismiss him, four more than the majority needed for the motion to carry. Defense Minister Abdullah Al-Sani was named to replace him. Libyan TV reported earlier that protesters demonstrating in front of the assembly's temporary headquarters at the Radisson Hotel had tried to storm the meeting but failed. The political drama followed news a North Korean-flagged oil tanker may have escaped a government naval blockade. A Libyan militia controlling the eastern port of Sidra defied government authority to load the tanker with oil. Various sources in Libya said the vessel had evaded government naval vessels and sailed to sea. Libyan Coast Guard Colonel Rida Issa indicated before the vote of no confidence the tanker had been targeted by Libyan vessels 55 miles off the coastal port of Sidra and that it had been disabled. Sky News Arabia reported that Libyan Coast Guard vessels had shelled the tanker, creating a small fire on board and forcing it to halt. The Islamist militia commander behind the recent tug of war with the government over the export of oil by the so-called regional government of Barka issued a statement calling for the United States to allow regions to export oil independently but oversee the financial transactions. The U.S. has condemned the sale of oil by any organization other than Libya's central government, calling attempted sales by the Barka region piracy. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's Wednesday morning, March 12, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A Namibian non-profit human rights organization has launched a nationwide voter campaign to educate prospective voters ahead of next year's general elections. Phil Yanagolo is executive director of NAM Rights. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that his group has partnered with the Electoral Commission to start voter education campaigns on radio and television stations, as well as on social media platforms.
We decide that this is a golden opportunity to launch a countrywide civic education as well as voter education drive in the country.
So far, how are Namibians in all corners of the country engaging in this education and sensitization exercise ahead of the election?
Indications are really the Namibians are really welcoming this, and we found out by means of Facebook and Twitter. We introduced it on Facebook, and it drew quite a large amount of people who are welcoming this type of voter education drive. This is an indication that indeed a lot of Namibians are really going to be motivated by this drive to come out and vote, not only vote for people who have done things in the past, but also people who are likely to do good things for the voters in the future.
Is your group working in cooperation with the Namibia electoral body?
Yes, indeed. We just have been meeting with the Electoral Commission last Thursday, and this was primarily to put up a good machinery of understanding and also of cooperation in the area, especially voter education and civic education. The Electoral Commission alone will not be able to do so, and by the way, a year before, a law has been adopted that this work of voter education must not only be left to the Electoral Commission of Namibia.
What do you think are the prospects of this voter education being successful, especially when recent reports show that there seem to be voter apathy in the country?
The prospects are, including to the 3 points that I have mentioned, are that we are also going to use radio and also video to educate these people. We have an agreement with a coalition of community radio throughout the country, through which this voter education awareness is also going to be driven. So there are really very good prospects also, because we are going to produce a video which will be transmitted from one cell phone to the other by, for example, Bluetooth, such that each and every person who needs that, they can always get it very easily without having access to the internet.
Phil Yanagolo is executive director of NAM Rights, a Namibia non-profit human rights organization. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Windhoek. Zimbabwe is said to be losing millions of dollars annually due to the importation of cheap clothing into the country. As Ivan Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe program reports from Harare, the Zimbabwe clothing industry is calling on the government to curb the cheap clothing imports.
Players in the clothing industry told Parliament's Industry and Commerce Portfolio Committee they are facing unfair competition from cheap imports from China and Dubai, adding 90% of these shipments are coming into the country duty-free. As a result, the Zimbabwean clothing industry says it is failing to compete, raising the need for the government to protect them. Zimbabwe Clothing Manufacturers Association Chairman Jeremy Yuman said most of the imports are not paying duty due to under-invoicing in quantities and value, abuse of trade agreements, and corruption, among other reasons.
If we were significantly above the international price, there wouldn't be a great motivation to cheat on the duties. But up to 90% of the clothing into this country comes in without paying the correct duties. That is estimated at our current market size at about $300 million worth, so we're missing out on approximately $120 million worth of revenue simply by it not being controlled.
Yuman said the industry can compete fairly if those clothes imports pay duty and correct government levies.
We need the protection of those garments that are coming in. The 40% duty that is there at the moment is not our duty. We never lobbied for it.
He said the industry, which is currently producing 25% of the country's demand, could increase production to 75% with enough support from the government. Human said the industry strongly supports the Buy Zimbabwe campaign, adding the culture of importing instead of local sourcing is hurting industry in general in the country. Besides protecting the industry, Human said government must provide a $2 million facility to enhance productivity in the industry, as well as a $5 million facility for distressed companies to source capital equipment and raw materials at competitive prices. Committee Chairman Ray Kaukonde said his committee will work with the government and industry to find solution to problems affecting the cotton industry. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Each year, 1 million babies are born with congenital heart defects. 10% of them do not live to see their first birthday due to lack of treatment, most of them in poor and developing countries. But an Israel-based organization is working to improve the survival rate of the children. Mariama Diallo reports on the group's plans to train Ethiopia's first pediatric cardiac surgeon and its efforts to raise money for a boy named Elias.
Since its creation in 1995, the organization Save a Child's Heart has been improving the quality of cardiac care for children in developing countries who suffer from heart disease. For the cost of $10,000, children are brought to Israel's Wolfson Medical Center to get the surgeries they need. Save a Child's Heart Executive Director David Litwack says their team of volunteers helps reduce the cost.
One of these operations in the United States could cost anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000, but for us it winds up being $10,000, and that regardless of how many surgeries they have, or how long they're in the hospital, or how complicated the case is, room and board in a children's home that we built 2 years ago for the child and his or her mother.
But the organization says its ultimate goal is to enable countries to treat their own children.
We made the commitment to do at least 50 children a year from Ethiopia. Equally important is that we have begun training what will be Ethiopia's first pediatric cardiac surgeon.
Recently, the medical group also trained Tanzania's first cardiac surgeon, a process that took 5 years. While 40% of the kids come from Africa, Save a Child's Heart has treated children from 48 different countries, including Eastern Europe, Asia, South America, and the Palestinian Authority. Save a Child's Heart's youth branch chairman in the United States is Michael Brown.
Just this last year, we started bringing children from Haiti, from El Salvador, from Peru. And in fact, this past summer, we started bringing children from Syria. So what this shows you is that we'll go wherever the need is.
Fundraisers and volunteer coordinators make miracles possible for the medical group. This fundraising event in Washington, which Brown helped to organize, is for a special boy.
The goal of tonight is to raise $10,000 to save the life of a young Ethiopian boy named Elias for the surgery that he needs to save his life.
Elias is 15 years old and one of 26 children who are being treated right now in Israel. The event raised more than $10,000, and Elias is among the more than 3,300 children the group has treated in the last decade. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Egyptian defending champions El Ahly play Libya's El Ahly Benghazi in the second round of the Orange African Champions League starting next week. According to the Confederation of African Football fixtures released in Cairo, Egypt on Tuesday, Congo Brazzaville's AC Leopards engage Sudan's El Hilal, Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports, and South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs engage engage the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe and AS Vita, respectively. In other matches, Algeria's Entente Setif welcomes Cameroon's Continent Sports. Guinea's Horoya play Tunisia's CS Faxian. Zambia's Nkana challenge Egypt's Zamalek as Mali's AS Real de Bamako encounters Tunisia's Esperance. Elsewhere, Rwanda's AS Kigali challenge Morocco's Difa Hassani El Jadidi in the second round of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup. Ghana's Mediama play Zambia's Zesco United as Egypt's Ismaili and Wadfi Degla host Angola's Athletics Petrolios and Mali's Joliba, respectively. Meanwhile, Nigeria's Warri Wolves and Bayelsa United encounter Tunisia's Bizertin and Zimbabwe's Howe Mines, respectively. Algeria's Constantinos play Ivory Coast ASEC Mimosa, and Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel encounter South Africa's Supersport United. Turning to basketball, Tunisia and Cameroon stage the 2015 African Basketball Championships, the continent's basketball controlling body FIBA Africa, revealed in Abidjan, Ivory Coast over the weekend. FIBA Africa has tasked Tunisia to host the men's championship, while Cameroon will stage the women's contest. Angola are on the standby to host either event should the need arise. The winners of each contest directly qualifies for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. Finally, in athletics, Uganda aim to stage a successful Africa Cross-Country Championships as part of their bid to convince the world they can host the 2017 IWF World Cross-Country Championships. The Uganda Athletics Federation Secretary General Beatrice Aikoru told the Kampala media on Tuesday, over 30 African countries converge in the Ugandan capital for the African Championship this coming weekend. Aikoru declared they are committed to ensure the success of the most high-profile international athletics event ever staged in Uganda. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, March 12.
To the medium once again to call on the federal government of Nigeria to better stop killing polytechnic education in Nigeria and settle the dispute between it and polytechnic lecturers. This call became very necessary following the non-attention of federal government to the striking polytechnic lecturers who have been on strike for the past 7 months plus, requesting for their statutory salary arrears and the removal of dichotomy between polytechnic graduate and university graduate, which have posed several trauma on polytechnic students. Albert Alagbo from Abudu Kato Ranch Festival Award in Obaliku local government area of Krasola State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Libya's parliament has ousted the nation's prime minister in a no-confidence vote after a North Korean-flagged tanker that illegally loaded crude oil at a rebel-held eastern port reportedly reached international waters. Angry deputies in the General National Congress, Libya's highest political authority, on Tuesday named the country's defense minister, Abdullah Al-Thani, as interim prime minister until a replacement for Ali Zidane is found. The move was prompted by news that the tanker Morning Glory had taken advantage of poor weather conditions to escape naval ships escorting it to a government port and head for open sea. There was no immediate reaction from Mr. Zidane on his ouster. Most politicians in Libya are backed by militias with regional or ideological allegiances. That's it for this Wednesday, March 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oldman, along with our engineer Jermaine Cook, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very lovely Wednesday.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.